Today on Talk to Tea, we riff with Kelly Garrett about her journey from C-suite executive to entrepreneur. Along the way, we explore pivot points, motherhood, perfectionism, elevated consciousness, and contentment. Let's dive in.
We welcome Kelly Garrett to our podcast today. You're welcome. It's so nice to hear you. And of course, see you, because I get to see you.
Yay.
Kelly is a recovering executive who is now a coach, speaker, and consultant on all things leadership. She is certified board director and Dare to Lead facilitator who teaches the work of Brené Brown. She is passionate about helping others get out of their own way so they can shine. Hey, Kelly.
Hello. I'm so passionate about that because I was so good at getting in my own way.
What a great launching point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to speak a little bit to that?
As you know, I was an accidental executive and I had zero aspirations on the career front. My goal in life was to snag a man and to live as hedonistically as possible. And so I did that for quite a while. And then I had kids, which was the first reckoning, I guess, and started getting promoted, because if you play well with others and you work your ass off and you are relatively intelligent, you just can't help yourself. You keep getting promoted. And the more I got promoted, the more I found creative ways to get in my own way. So my high standards, which was my justification for perfectionism, would translate into behavior that was not helpful or uplifting for the people who worked for me. And so that was one of the ways I got in my own way and actually got in their own way. And I had the gift of many executive coaches over the years who helped me see that a strength overplayed is a flaw, and that you have to learn how to use the throttle and you have to care about your impact on others and all these things that seem so obvious now, but were not obvious to me at all then. So I just became intrigued by how the way we habitually behave is like water to a fish. And we don't even notice what our impact is on others, partly because we're so concerned about what's going on in our own heads. Mm. So that's why I became quite obsessed, actually, with helping others get out of their own way, because I see so many talented individuals who are truly stumped at why they aren't progressing towards whatever goal or aspiration they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible to be able to provide that insight. And it is a phenomenon of being human, unless you're, you have been introduced to the world of coaching, that what is in our blind spot or the subtleties even underneath our conversations or actions, that we just, can't access them.
Yeah, being human, damn it, it's annoying.
Right? So, you're super playful about your career, and you had a boomer career. You had an incredibly successful run, shall we say, as an executive. Can you touch a little bit about your background and what that actually looked like?
Sure. So I actually am at the tail end of the boomers. And so now you know how old I am. Okay. I actually initially wanted to be a psychologist because I was always fascinated by how people tick. But I didn't really want to go to school that long. So I did a wildly impractical English and philosophy degree and promptly took off on a sailboat for 2 years with five guys. And when I came back, the only jobs available to people with an impractical arts degree at the beginning of the 80s was being a secretary if one was a woman. And so I was a Kelly girl for a while, you know me, imagine me with a "Hi, I'm Kelly" from Kelly Girl badge, which they made you wear, and ended up going back to school because I couldn't bear it, and did an advertising public relations diploma, and then couldn't believe that I got paid to write and talk. So I worked in healthcare in Ontario for a while, and then became obsessed with having a child. I held my cousin's baby when I was 28, and it was like, get me with child. It was irrational. I had never wanted a child. Suddenly, you know, want a child so badly. My mother had died that year at 48 from breast cancer, which was wrenching. Mm-hmm. So I promptly get myself with child and decide I want to have four little goomers and be a stay-at-home mother because self-awareness was not my strong suit. And we move halfway across Canada to the prairies. I increase the population the next month so that it was 1,000,000+1 here in Saskatchewan and lasted 4 months. Like, I think being a mother is the hardest thing anybody could do. And I certainly found very creative ways to get in my way and theirs. I was a bit of a screamer. And so I ended up taking a job at Farm Credit after a term somewhere else and thought, this is a great sleepy crown to work at while my kids don't sleep, and ended up rocketing through the ranks. And as I said earlier, I think if you have the triple crown of getting along well with others, not just tolerating them, but genuinely connecting with them and working your ass off and being relatively good at what you do and intelligent, then you keep getting promoted. The mm-hmm. problem is you get promoted for the technical skills. You don't get promoted other than the connection with people for much else. And we're not really trained for much else as leaders. So I first was promoted to VP communications, then moved into marketing and product development and knew nothing about financial product development. So that was scary. And then ultimately became a senior VP of business strategy and enterprise risk. So that was a total 180 from what I had ever intended to do. Mm-hmm. And because I felt that I lacked credentials, I started credential seeking behavior in earnest and did an MA in leadership and started getting a bunch of other certifications. And the thing that always fascinated me more than the work itself was how to draw the best out of people and how different people require such different ways of drawing out that potential. And that just fascinated me, and in a way is totally linked to my earlier desire to be a psychologist. So when I was 53, I thought, well, my mother expired at 48. I'm getting on in years. I'm going to jump and become an entrepreneur, and became an executive coach and a speaker. And I do Brené Brown workshops and various other types of things.
Nice. Thanks for all of that. It's I can hear, well, my listening certainly is like hearing the what I like to call the pivot points and the honing of your path in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. And there's so many things there I just like that I hear that I would love to dive into. One is, you know, if I kind of trace back your speaking a little, I was hearing you talk about motherhood first. And one of the things that I certainly experienced in motherhood was that was the most excruciating experience of self-reflection. There's something about watching those little beings and seeing reflected behavior that it was my first reckoning with holy wow me.
Holy wow me. That? I love that. Well, I thought I was a wonderful person before I became a mother. Like, I really did. I didn't think I was perfect, but I thought I was kind and empathetic and patient, and all that went out the window, you know. For one thing, Connor, my second child, who was later diagnosed with autism, didn't sleep the night till he was 3 years old. And he would get up anywhere from 6 to 10 times a night. And I felt like I had a buzz at the base of my skull from lack of sleep. And that doesn't really put one on our best behavior. So, lots of times staring at a wine glass, why am I yelling at them so swiftly? Why am I not more tolerant of little kid behaviors that are just normal little kid behaviors? I mean, kids are loud. They're loud when they are happy. They're loud when they hurt themselves. They're loud when they're frustrated. And I discovered I had a real sensitivity to noise. And it was one of the things I hated about my own mother, because she was like that. And so there were so many humbling examples I could give you about where I didn't behave in sync with what I felt I was really. And lots of time apologizing to the kids. So my older son says, you know, one of the things you modeled, Mom, is that we screw up and we make up and we apologize and we're accountable. And I'm like, okay, well, at least there's one silver lining in your childhood.
That's awesome. He's very, obviously he takes after Mama and his brilliance. That was actually a pretty amazing little recap for you. Generous, generous soul.
Very generous. Yes.
Yeah. 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 It's so true. Hey, it's well, and I also in that, you know, that disconnect between our relationship to ourselves, like kind and patient, and then these little beings, and then opposite of behavior, or, you know, it's that the dichotomous nature of those two pieces. It's like, to me, you know, me, transformational space. Wait a sec, you know, two opposing factors. I experience myself as this over here, and yet there's this over there, which is quite in the face of that. So, mm-hmm. and then I guess some of us might just bypass that and overlook it rather than examine it. But it's, you know, my experience of you is like, that was a place for reflection. And, mm-hmm. you know, with that psychology pull that you definitely, you and I share, is the looking into that and reflecting on it a little more and doing something with it.
And it wasn't smooth in terms of reflection. Like,
yeah,
I hate feeling stupid. And when you keep reflecting on the same bad behavior, AKA yelling at the kids, like I remember one time the two of them were on the stairs a few feet away from me. And I was looking down at them yelling, "Stop yelling." And they kind of looked at me and I started laughing. And then they're like, because is it safe to laugh? Because that's Mom's mad face. And, you know, then thinking about it after, it's like, oh, man, like, how many times do I have to do this before I finally get in the moment, you know, that whole space between stimulus and response that Frankl says, and I actually can halt myself in the moment. It took me a long, long time.
Yeah. Yes. Repeat behavior, do something with it, or what is it? Version of insanity, do the same thing over and over, expecting a different outcome.
Yes, that's me.
And me, and probably a good portion of our listeners for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can sit and laugh in hindsight. But what would you actually say to, you know, a young executive with little ones? Any words of wisdom?
Well, I think I hate gender generalizations, but I will generalize here. I think women, female executives more than male executives, are much harder on themselves on the home front. Still seem to feel it is more their role than the father, if there is that kind of relationship at play, to be the one organizing everything with the kids, to run a perfect house, to help the kids with their homework, you name it. There are enlightened men and enlightened partner relationships where that is not the case, but with an awful lot of women in particular, I see that. And so my advice to female executives is to just frickin' lower your standards. I was lucky. I was naturally pigpenish in terms of my housekeeping skills, emerging from an OCD mother who was immaculate. And that seems like a funny thing to say, but I think women pour so much energy into trying to create some kind of perfection at work and at home in a way that men seem to let themselves off the hook for. And so that's just one example of finding a way to grant yourself grace and just lower your standards. You know, the best business strategies don't say, let's be world-class at every single thing we do, because mm-hmm. that is a shocking waste of resources, human and financial. You choose which things to excel at and which things to just get her done. And I think men and women, but I seem to see it more with women, especially if you're at the executive ranks where you have way too many demands, mm-hmm. need to discern what really requires quality attention. Kids come to mind. And what doesn't, and mm-hmm. just let the rest go. That's really hard for hard driving, high performing people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That 100%. And to piggyback on that, you know, thinking about choosing what is that thing that you would excel at if it's a matter of prioritization. There we go. Thank you. That was definitely couldn't put my brain around that word. Yes. When it comes to prioritizing, there we go. It's a struggle. It's also can be a place for further reflection. It can be a place of, yeah, what is actually important? Because if you are wired toward that perfectionism, that can be like the first stumbling block. Which one do I pick up?
Terrible one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any advice there?
Well, it's funny. It took me a long time to realize I was a perfectionist because of my aforementioned pig pen tendencies. So I equated perfectionists with people who were like my mother, who had a perfect house and they looked perfect and all those kinds of things. I didn't relate it to a standard of work or quality or things like that. So I started realizing that one of my not so great traits, which is procrastination, was actually related to the perfectionism because nothing was ever up to my standard. So I needed a super hard deadline staring me in the face before I would create whatever it was that needed to be created and then just get it out the door. And then it had to go out in whatever, at whatever level of quality it ended up being. Mm-hmm. If I have too much time, even now I struggle. I will hone and polish and like just overdo the work on it. So I think the first step, as with everything, and you know this as well or better than me, is awareness. So, oh, I am doing it. And then put some strategies in place in terms of what might help get you off the perfectionism hamster wheel. And so one of those things is this one of these get or done good enough things, or is this something super high quality, something that requires super high quality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, really great. It's and you know what pops up for me there is I remember you know, a pivot point in my own career, which was that dance with cancer. And at that, you know, point, the kids were like 6 and 8. And I too was a driven, like, perfectionist and massive work ethic, you know. Worked ridiculous hours, but, you know, also this massive commitment to these little beings. And my anchor after that dabble with death was, or, you know, mortality, probably a better way to describe it, was, it was like a reckoning around heart versus head. You know, yeah. It was that prioritizing matters of the heart versus matters of the head. You know, a lot of books written on this and maybe a little cliched, but it certainly was true for me. Mm-hmm. It was all of a sudden my life rejigged, and I began to orient myself around matters of the heart versus matters of the head. And that really helped me sort out that perfectionist piece. And I, you know, I hear you too, your mom passing young, and that gap for you between looking at how young she was and then your young years, which I still attest, you know, young years at, that reckoning for you too seemed to be a pivot point as well.
Yes, I would say I've had two dramatic reckonings on the mortality front and one emerging one. So the first one was when I was living on the sailboat. We were caught in a storm at sea. We were about 1,200 miles east of North Carolina on our way to the Caribbean, and we were hit by a northern gale, and the mainsail ripped in half, and the waves were as high as the mast, which was 40 feet high, and we really didn't think we were going to make it. And we joked for the month after that, it took us 10 more days to make landfall in the Caribbean, that we would never take our lives for granted ever again after that terror. And it lasted about a month. You know, we were appreciating the green in the leaves, and, you know, we were not fighting at all because there's six people living in a really confined space. So then, you know, when you become acclimatized again to life and not focusing on death, we go back to our little habits of irritation over not much. The second one was when my mother died. I mean, someone hale and hearty and vibrant and very healthy and physically active expiring at 48 is just cruel. And I felt like, you know, seize the day. I only have 18 years left, apparently, because I was 30 when she died. And it doesn't last. So yay for you that it did last, but it didn't last for me. I went back to seize the day and living life with all its my wonderful qualities and my small self qualities. Mm-hmm. What I find now is I'm 61, and my family, you know, the person who's lived the longest is like 83 years old, and most live not as long as that. So without being a macabre, I have really started looking at what do I want to be spending my time doing versus not. And mm-hmm. that is a wonderful antidote for perfectionism.
Yeah.
So if I only have 10 more years on earth, or even 20, do I really want to be perfecting whatever this thing is in front of me? No. And what feeds my soul? Does this? No. So I'm saying no a lot more. And I love Greg McKeon's book. I don't know if that's how you say his name, Essentialism. And he has a new book out called Effortless. And I just started reading that one. But Essentialism is one of the few books I've read three times. And he talks about how we need to be very conscious about what we're saying yes to versus no, to ensure that what's essential in our lives, you know, being there for little ones, as you said, little beings, I like how you say that, or looking after one's health, or pick a story. It can be vocational. You know, I love my work, but I can get so into my work that it excludes much else in my life. And I don't want that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Such a great point. I the words that sort of pop for me when you speak about this is life is precious and urgent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thank you for the compliment that I maybe learned to hang out there. Most certainly I did not. So obviously I get 10 points for looking good, but definitely lost my way It's so interesting. You know, I think I got a 5-year ride out of that experience. And then it's interesting. I then became arrogant again about my life. And I would say squandered precious time that, you know, like a few years previous, I would be like, no way, this is urgent. You know, life is precious. But it is interesting how it tends to wear off a little, and we might float back to our arrogant selves.
and it's lovely when we forget about mortality. I mean, I think one of the gifts of being healthy, if we're lucky enough to be healthy, is that we forget for periods of time that, you know, life is precious, as you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Kelly, you love to dabble in elevated consciousness.
Probably because it's eluded me a lot.
Well, so, and as we were speaking and you were speaking, I was thinking about the, you know, those moments in time where we got present to something that altered our, you know, the course of our life, our behavior, our choices, our priorities, and I kind of like to relate to those moments as moments of elevated consciousness, if you will, or what we might define as that. You know, it's such lofty words, right? But it's those moments in time where we really get present to what is truly important. And to me, they're soulful, they're spiritual, they're heart-based. I assert that at that pivot point from executive to like really making that jump to entrepreneur might have been one of those moments for you. Mm-hmm. Want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm playing with an acronym I call CAPE because I'm writing a book. And to me, the C is what is calling you, not what is your calling, but what is calling you and cannot be ignored. Mm-hmm. And the A is awareness, partly of how you're getting in your own way. And P is patterns and practices. And then E is elevated consciousness. And so for me, the calling of wanting more freedom, freedom's my number one value, more independence, more ability to be creative, all of those things that are quite difficult in the container of being an executive. I mean, I pushed it about as far as a body could push it. But, you know, if I truly felt that if I were to continue my journey of some kind of self-actualization, I needed to jump. And so the calling of the soul almost became so insistent that I did jump. And, you know, I come from very humble beginnings financially, and executives earn a lot of money. I have a son with autism and one fears, have we really put aside enough for this child when we're gone? Because he will need more support than my other son. All those things factor into play. And I started to feel like a vice in terms of perhaps preventing me from leaping. And I ultimately, the calling was so great that I felt I felt like it was not a desire anymore. It was an actual need that I was required to do it. I think the other aspect of elevated consciousness is not about us as much as it is about perhaps compassion and grace, even if you don't let the other person off the hook for their behavior and where they are in their journey. And I don't think elevated consciousness means it's a static, oh yay, I'm operating on this plane that is stratospherically higher than I used to be. I think it is something we glimpse at times, and then, oh, you know, the cloud is obscuring it again. And I have this artist friend, Tom McInnes, who actually made me a mobile that he called elevated consciousness. And the symbol he came up with for it is tiny in the scheme of the mobile, because it's a fleeting glimpse we get now and then. And no matter what level you're operating at, there's always another level that you could, that you can catch a glimpse of. And so that's what fascinates me. And now I find when someone is engaging in behavior that, you know, I really find difficult. I mean, all this bipolar political stuff going on in the US and even in Canada has really brought this to the fore for me, is, you know, what is it that they can't see right now? And how can I be compassionate about that, even if I completely disagree with wherever they're at?
Yeah. Yes. Definitely. Which, wow, we dove into that topic. I'm pretty sure that's a booking for another session, that one right there. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I love what you said about the, well, there's a couple of things that, you know, if I just slow down, because I'm excited by all the breadcrumbs you just dropped for us here. You know, if I think about, for you and I, we swim in this ocean of, you know, now we're in our businesses. We've been in our businesses for a while. And I often challenge myself to think back to when I wasn't necessarily doing this work in this business, that there were, you know, obviously other businesses I was a part of that were deemed more sensible, I quote, rather than this gig we got with in terms of being coaches. But, you know, when I was in the trappings of the more sensible business, that leap to do something that my heart just said, that soul capture, that this is your purpose moment, it seemed ludicrous. And yet you and I both did it. And I know what it was for me, but I mean, what would you say to someone that isn't swimming in this particular ocean? We crossed the bridge, but what would you say to them in that vice grip, or, you know, golden handcuffs, as we love to say, of that position? Yeah.
What would you say? It's such an individual choice. You know, I've seen some people jump who really didn't have the credentials or experience to financially, to create a financially viable enterprise, even if it was an enterprise of one that is a solo entrepreneur like I am. So I think there's an element of practicality in terms of, so your soul is calling you to jump and do something different. Yay. How do I heed that and still feed myself and or my family, depending on how many people you have responsibility for? So I think it takes that blend of the esoteric and the practical. Esoteric in the sense that what is calling to you may seem not sensible, as you put it, compared to staying in a good paying job and going there every day. And yeah, it might be squashing your soul a little because it's a little too predictable or whatever it is. But I think we need to be practical while looking at how to follow the call of the soul. And for some of us, it might mean getting a credential or two first before we jump, joining in something on a volunteer basis to round out our skills or fulfill a side of us that is not fulfilled in the work context. So I'm kind of sounding like I'm raining on the entrepreneurial drive, and I'm not. I think that if you really feel a call to be an entrepreneur, you should heed it. And just like anything else, it's a business that you are embarking on. So you need to be mindful of putting the foundation in place to be able to make it your business and not be forced to go back into corporate land because you didn't have the right market in place or the right building blocks.
Yeah. I think if you and I had known each other back when I jumped. For me, it was a little different. I hit a wall emotionally. Mm. It's a time where I like to think like what I was doing that was practical. It was like emotionally bankrupt is what I like. I like to describe it.
Yeah.
I couldn't pick up one more file. I physically had this file, you know, stack of files on my desk, and I physically wouldn't touch it. And if it's interesting what you said about that entrepreneurial drive, you know, like having that peace within, because if someone were to look at what I was about to do, leaving behind that predictable income with, you know, two little kids and being single at the time and, you know, responsible for raising these kids and at a very expensive time of their life as well.
Yeah.
You know, you probably would have yelled at me. What are you doing, crazy woman? Mm. But at the time, I think that, you know, so maybe what I'm tapping on is that there are a couple of things present for me that might be useful to think about, is that I'd had an entrepreneurial model in my parents who emigrated.
Mm. Yeah.
But I always wonder, you know, how come I did the impractical? Because I totally agree with what you're saying, you know, credential, you know, make sure you got a foundation underneath you. And that was not necessarily my journey, but what I did have behind me was an entrepreneurial model.
Right.
Tenacity, resilience, you know, watching my parents slug it out as immigrants in Canada with no foundation. And it was kind of a, you know, a situation where my dad had run out of the type of work that he was trained to do. And out of sheer necessity and desperation, created this business and a determination that was like, hell yeah, I'm going to make it. This family's mm-hmm. going to make it. You know, so I kind of wonder about that. If you don't have that, do you have this foundation, this model mm-hmm. that sort of runs through you?
And yeah. I don't want to place undue emphasis on the notion that you got to get credentials and you have to do all this other crap. I think that some people have an entrepreneurial drive and also a model, as you referenced with your parents. I came from a family where I didn't know any entrepreneurs mm-hmm. on either side of the family, generations. Like they just weren't entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And so I never considered myself an entrepreneur, never thought I would become one, et cetera. But what you reference in terms of resilience and tenacity and so on, I think are qualities that may be as important or more important than what I just mentioned in terms of, you know, credentials and market and all the rest of it. I think one of the other things, whether you have an entrepreneurial drive or not, or you're toying with the idea and not sure if you have the drive, is that my father always used to say, life's a trade-off. Mm. And that sounds so patently obvious, but it's true. When we're going to jump from corporate land to becoming an entrepreneur, we need to understand the trade-off. And the trade-off is, I am going to leave this place that may be squashing my soul for various reasons, might work with decent people and so on, but it just ain't it for me. And I'm going to jump, and there's an attendant risk. For sure, there is a drop in income instantly for most of us, not all. Mm-hmm. And you know, you have to suss out your market and finesse what your offerings are and all those kinds of things. And as long as you face it with the cold light of day, in terms of the trade-off is freedom, and there is a price. And it may not be a price for a long time, depending on how well you do, but it is a trade-off. You rarely in life have everything all at once. And yeah. If you do, be suspicious because it probably won't last.
Totally, right? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Most certainly, I think. And it's easy to look now at, you know, 17 years later, that there's a, you know, degree of success and foundation, but make no mistake, and I'm sure you can attest to this also, many hours spent in the business, you know, working on it, when a lot of people think, oh, it's, you know, glide. No, it's not. It's still finger on the pulse. And, but I also think when you're doing what you love, you know, sometimes Allison has to slap my hand away from the computer, right? Like there's a, hey, yeah. Isn't this the gardening break? So there's definitely that, but I think that, you know, the journey that, you know, the tough parts lasted much longer than I anticipated. That struggle, you know, was heart-wrenching sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think if I had of had, you know, something that I watched where, you know, this is your life rolling out. This is, you know, will you choose this? I would have said, oh, hell no, in that moment. You know, like hindsight now is like, oh yeah, that was really tough, but you kind of, you're in it, you're stepping through it. You're like, I'm committed now, here mm-hmm. I go. But there were times where, yeah, I think if I'd had known what was coming, that I might have chosen differently. You sure? And I actually, this is a good point to bring in something that you say, and that is self-compassion is the partner of mental toughness. And some of my toughest times was when I was beating the heck out of myself, you know, about something I should have done better or said or done different, or, you know, choices that I made. Or so talk to me about self-compassion as the partner of mental toughness. What's that for you?
Well, I have always valued being stoic and strong. And I had a few periods in my life where I did not feel very strong. When Connor was diagnosed with autism, I basically fell apart for a couple of years. I soldiered on and got my work done and managed not to cry at work and things like that. But I was really, really struggling. And I used to view self-compassion as letting ourselves off the hook and being wussy almost. And so I became quite interested when I heard of it, of the concept of mental toughness, and started reading about Navy SEALs and so on. And I was shocked to learn that they are taught self-compassion, because in the midst of unspeakably hard trials that the likes of us will never have physically anyway, they are taught to face their fear, to acknowledge it, to give themselves self-compassion for feeling it in order to move on. So it's almost like Carl Jung, who says, what you resist persists. If you don't allow the feeling to flower and acknowledge it, you can't move past it. And that didn't make any sense to me, because to me, I felt like, especially those 2 years, I had actually allowed myself to feel it all right. I mean, I was wallowing in it. But there's a difference between wallowing and self-compassion. And the other side of it that fascinated me was, apparently, the less self-compassion you show for yourself, the less empathy you can show others. And Brené Brown references the work of Teresa Wiseman in her own work, and talking that empathy is a really, really important antidote to shame, and that we all experience shame unless we're a sociopath. And shame can be a micro moment. It doesn't have to be monumental like murder. It can be feeling shame for yelling at your kid, or feeling shame when you got called out in a meeting and you feel that hot flush. That the only way through it is to feel self-compassion for yourself. And I have found that a real struggle. So back to my earlier point, we can grow our empathy for others only by growing our self-compassion. And so I'm really other oriented, and that appealed to me. So in a funny kind of way,
yeah,
that gave me license to give myself self-compassion. So, you know, the things of wishing I had been shown up differently as a mother at times, divorcing my first husband very swiftly and not having enough empathy for him, and beating myself up over that over the years, even though we stayed friends. It didn't match my very high standard of how I should behave at all times. So, yeah, I think the whole self-compassion thing is interesting and required to do hard things, including be an entrepreneur and jump and make mistakes, which as humans, we all do.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I love that. You know, it's almost, you know, tricking yourself in a way, but it's very authentic. It's that, you know, you're very other oriented, as you said, and seeing the opportunity. It's like, hey, if you're not going to bring yourself self-compassion just because, then in order to be more for others, that's the way. What a perfect setup for you to actually address self-compassion and to grow compassion for self. I also love what you said about those micro moments of shame. I like to think of those as like, you know, it's kind of like if you leave a bucket out in the weather, you know, you think, oh, there's just small sprinkles, but pretty soon you look and there's about 3 inches in there. And those micro moments of shame sure add up to big buckets of shame.
Oh, that's so true. That's a great analogy.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you, what are your thoughts on what would you say to someone who is just beginning to recognize those micro moments of shame?
Read Brené Brown's work. She's got excellent advice and practical skills to help you deal with it. I think that Brené has done a lot of good work on the notion that we are inherently worthy and deserving of love and belonging exactly as we are. And I think so many of us do not feel that way. I mean, I was at least sort of aware that I was equating who I was with what I did for a very long time. It's difficult to shed that. It's difficult to stop using the drug of accomplishment to define who you are and to really believe that with all of your imperfections, you're deserving of love and belonging. I love that. I wouldn't say I'm completely there all the time, but I am much more likely to think of my flaws in an almost warm and kind way, aka self-compassionate, than I ever would have thought possible. And it just makes life better. It doesn't mean that you lower your standards and you stop striving to be a better human. It does mean that you grant yourself grace and move on.
Nice. Grant yourself grace and move on. You also use the word contentment.
I picked it as my word for the year. And it felt funny picking it because it felt like it wasn't a striving word. And I'm always striving for something. And COVID has really forced me to stop, like it has so many of us. I went from racing around all the time, only being home for 6 nights the February month before COVID started, and to being home ever after. And I work out of my home, so that wasn't a problem. But life has become very predictable and quotidian. And I have found an amazing contentment during this time that I never would have believed possible. And so I really want to sustain that when we start seeing humans in the flesh again, other than the ones we live with. And so contentment doesn't have to be the antithesis of excitement. It can be a grounding, wonderful way of being.
I love that. I love that. And it's funny, my experience of you in your way of being is contentment. There's a grace and space and calm about you. An incredible, you know, experience of compassion. So a testament to obviously the deep thinking and the reflecting that you've been doing. And it shows all over you.
Yay!
Yay! Do you thinking back to your, where you were completely immersed in that exact world, if we told you that you would be here today, would you have believed us? And that wasn't a setup for, I'm really curious.
You know, the funny thing about me is I always have had a grounded quality, even in the midst of the frenetic years. My father called me La 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 Kelly. I was so relaxed, which I kind of lost her for quite a while. I am surprised at the degree to which I regained her. And I am super surprised that I find contentment to be a goal that is fun. That was so not me in the midst of those years.
Nice. I love it. A goal that is fun.
Another goal?
No, I was curious about that statement, a goal that is fun. What makes
it? Yeah, because it sounded too boring. Contentment just sounded like you're just dwelling in whatever space you're in, both physically and metaphorically. And it didn't appeal to me. I was all about Tawanda. What's the next groovy thing that I can try and aspire to and master before I find another one and cram as much as I can because life is short. And now I live with a Zen master. I mean, he can sit on a rock and look at the water for an hour with no book or nothing in his hand, which is not a natural state for me. And yeah, the gifts of being content, I think, are very unexpected. I would never have expected it. And I have this sign on my desk that Oscar Wilde said. He said, to do nothing at all is the most difficult thing in the world, the most difficult and the most intellectual. And I find being able to just sit with feelings or sit with birds or nothing or stare at the handiwork of my flower garden is partially difficult and partially so soul fulfilling and inducing of contentment.
I found that when I love Brené Brown, and to quote her often, you know, I love her rumbling. You know, I needed to rumble with those micro moments of shame in order to access like my true contented self. And I found that expanding my compassion and my compassion for self, and then of course others, really allowed me to sit on the rock longer. I noticed in those moments where I would latch onto, you know, the latest thing that I was holding against myself, that it was the thing that interrupted my log sitting or my, you know, rock dwelling. So, you know, any thoughts on that yourself?
Oh, the inner chatter of, they say that the way we speak to ourselves is a way we would never dream of speaking to somebody else. And that is so true. And so, and becomes so habitual that we don't even notice that that voice isn't us. And I've become quite fascinated lately in my quest for elevated consciousness with psychosynthesis. Mm-hmm. And so as Yolaji, who developed it, grew the work of Carl Jung, and he talks about disidentifying the subpersonalities that we all have, and the subpersonalities are the different facets of ourselves that Jung talked about. And so what I've started to play with myself and with clients is to identify what those voices are and not identify with those voices, which psychosynthesis calls disidentification. So it's to look at them as perhaps that voice served me at one time, and to be okay with its existence. And people talk about slaying dragons and or gremlins, and I don't know that you can slay every dragon. I think you can slay some of them, but I think for some of them, you just need to look at them in the face, say you don't get to run the show anymore, and I accept that you're part of me, but you are not me.
Yeah.
And so to notice when the critical voices are showing up and to give them some compassion, funny enough, calms them down, and they can go lie down in the corner and be a benign dragon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I always like to, you know, think of them as little people, and we wouldn't let them drive the car.
Right.
Oftentimes I'll ask mine to get in the back seat and jump in their car seat. Right. It's like,
that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. I really love what you said. And I know we have to, you know, put a wrap on this. Certainly hope you'll come on back and visit us down the road. Yeah. Awesome. Two thumbs up. And, but definitely that notion of, I can't exactly recall how you phrased it, but the what did you say about identification? Could you just repeat what you said about that in the
psychosynthesis?
Synthesis?
Yes. Yeah, try to say that fast and repetitively.
Yeah, psychosynthesis.
That we need to disidentify with all of the disparate subpersonalities. They're part of who we are. They're facets of who we are, but they aren't who we are.
Yeah.
There is a still essence or center of ourself that he called self, that is just a clear pool of awareness that isn't attached to any of those subpersonalities. So we get messed up when we think, I am this, I am my job, I am this kind of person. Well, that might be part of you, but it isn't all of you.
Yeah, totally. And that notion too, that I'm really clear that those parts served me at one point.
Yes.
And I actually, you know, at times to, you know, time to time, I'll partner with them intentionally for the very nature that they bring. You know, if I have to finish something or, you know, partnering with them for the quality that they bring, but being able to recognize when they're running the show and it's detrimental is a brilliant thing.
That's a very hard thing. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Kelly, is there anything else in parting, anything we haven't asked you or that you haven't said that you'd love to share right now?
You know, I have been obsessed with peace since I was 5 years old. I had drawn a windmill and my mother said it looked like a swastika and I didn't know what that was. And that's when I first learned about what war was because she told me about it. So I would just say, I am feeling very much feeling with what is going on the other side of the world right now with renewed war. And there's always war going on around the world. And I think the more we can find some peace in our own hearts and contentment, the more we will exude that, and the more we can influence everyone around us to be more self-compassionate and empathetic towards others. And maybe in some small way that'll change the world and we will have peace.
Yeah. Beautiful place to just put a full stop on that. Kelly, thank you so much for bringing that and concluding with that piece and all that you've brought today. It's always amazing to be with you. You are a brilliant, compassionate, generous soul.
Right back at you, Tracy Burns.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much.
Okay, till next time.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Talk to Tea with Kelly Garrett. If you haven't done so already, don't forget to subscribe and always leave room for a little magic in your life.